You're listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast series. How did freedom fare in the Supreme Court this year? A panel with Amy Peacock, Larry Saltzman, and Steve Simpson.
All right, thanks very much for everybody coming. I gather you're either really interested in Supreme Court issues or really not interested in physics. I'm just kidding about that. Keith's discussion on physics, I'm sure, is super amazing. But anyway, so is the Supreme Court. So we have lots to say. There's actually a couple interesting things going on in the Supreme Court this term. And so we're going to try to talk about a number of those. But let me first introduce, for those of you who don't know, I'm Steve Simpson, as Anu said. I'm the Director of Legal Studies at the Ayn Rand Institute. I'm a lawyer. I practiced at the Institute for Justice for many years, and that's enough about me. Let me go to my co-panelists. Actually, I'm going to start with Amy. Amy Peacock, a lot of you know she often participates in Yaron Brooks' various podcasts and radio shows, and Amy has done her own radio shows and has appeared on it's Fox News, I guess, with Tucker Carlson on many occasions. Amy is a lawyer, a former law professor, and a PhD in philosophy. So I think you taught at Chapman for a while, and you taught at Southwestern Law School, right? And I know you've some teaching as a philosophy professor. Was it the Air Force Academy?
Yeah.
Yeah. So and plus all kinds of really interesting things. You can find all kinds of good commentary from Amy if you follow her on Facebook, and I'm sure there are other places that you can, if you watch
a little snark on Twitter.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. No, you're really good at snark on Twitter. I like your posts. So that's Amy. Amy is also, I should say, an expert on Fourth Amendment, which is useful because their very big Fourth Amendment case came out this term, and we're going to talk about that case, the Carpenter case. To my right is Larry Saltzman. Larry is currently a senior attorney at the Pacific Legal Foundation. He also runs a clinic in association with PLF and at Chapman University, right? That's true. Okay, good. I want to make sure I have that right. But Larry has also, it's easy for me to forget this, but he's also on the board of directors of ARI, so he's kind of my boss, but I'm kidding. I first met Larry at an OCON years ago, I think in Las Vegas, and after that he ended up coming to the Institute for Justice, so he and I overlapped at IJ for a number of years. So Larry's worked at IJ, and the last thing I think really interesting about you is that you're an entrepreneur as well. So here's a guy who's covered a lot of different bases in his life. And one thing that I'll mention about this panel is that we have really wide and interesting experience. So you can talk to all of us. I've been talking to people throughout OCON about legal careers and all the various things that you can do with a law degree, and you're seeing three really good examples of that. So let me kick off the topic. The title of this panel is How Did Freedom Fare in the Supreme Court? There are a couple of reasons for choosing that title. One, it's interesting and important to know how freedom did. The other is when you don't know the decisions that are going to come down and you're picking a title early on, you have to come up with something generic that allows you to cover anything. So How Did Freedom Fare was about the best I could get. If I redid it, I would say How Did Freedom and the Rule of Law Fare in the Supreme Court. But there's a lot to say about both these topics, and I want to kind of set up the panel that way. So we're going to go through and talk about a number of high-profile decisions. The Carpenter case, so it's Carpenter versus United States, that's the Fourth Amendment cell phone tracking case, although the first one we're going to talk about is Hawaii versus Trump, that's the immigration case. We'll probably talk a bit about the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, which is the gay wedding cake case. We'll talk about the big union case, Janus versus AFSCME. There's another case called NIFLA. I forget what NIFLA stands for, but it's the pregnancy center disclosure case. And then if we have time, there are a couple others we may talk about. We're going to try to focus on those. And the idea is to do two things, really. It's to tell you about what's happening in these cases and why they're important, whether they're good, bad, or otherwise. They're all important decisions. To give you a sense of what the court did, but also then to branch out and talk about some broader themes. One of the themes will be how freedom did in the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. But there are a number of other themes, and they're important to understand, especially in today's world. So another thing happened at the Supreme Court last week. I don't know if anybody's aware of this, but Justice Kennedy retired. So that's going to be a big deal, obviously, in the court. But thinking about that debate and how people think about what it means for a justice to retire, what impact it will have on the court, does it make sense to look at this as a left versus a right faction with Kennedy as the swing justice? I think there's a lot of things wrong with that. But I mean, a lot of the themes we'll be talking about bear on that. We'll give you guys enough time to ask questions. We're not going to, I think, address Kennedy's retirement in the main session. So if people want to know about it, I don't really know why anybody would. But if anybody wants to ask his questions about that, obviously ask the question, and we'll do our best to talk about that. But there's a lot more to talk about. And part of the reason, so one of the reasons to focus on Supreme Court cases from our perspective as objectivists is that if you think about what happens during the course of any given year in this country, and you ask yourself, when is it that people are focused on things like philosophy and big ideas? One big time period or series of time periods is when the Supreme Court is issuing decisions. It's really a unique kind of time period in this country, in the sort of political, ideological, cultural streams in this country, is that people actually take ideas seriously, whether they know it or not. They talk about ideas while the Supreme Court is issuing big decisions. And it's a really good opportunity for us to get out there and to introduce better ideas and just to talk about what's happening. But there's all kinds of, you know, different ways to understand what the court does. So just very quickly before we turn to the first case, I'll mention three themes in addition to freedom that we're going to try to get across to you. One of them is context matters. How cases get to the Supreme Court, the types of issues that the Supreme Court deals with, the court versus other branches of government is a big deal that nobody really gets, and I think this will come up in the Hawaii case. People have this view of the Supreme Court that it's just supposed to rove, and this is all across the ideological spectrum. I see everybody from every kind of philosophical perspective, including objectivists, thinking this kind of thing, that the Supreme Court's job is just to rove around and correct all the stuff that I can't stand, or all the stuff that I think is bad, or all the stuff that the founders thought was bad, or... And it's really wrong. There's a whole lot, there's some right about that, and there's a whole lot wrong with it. And it's useful to remember that the court is one branch, and there are two other branches of government that are supposed to do jobs in all of this, and they also have a role to play. So context, understanding the context in which the Supreme Court functions. Another is just interesting trends or possibly, you know, promising lines of thought that are emerging in a lot of these cases that may turn into really fascinating and interesting, radical, earth-shattering kinds of things, and we'll try to talk about a bunch of those. You can see a lot of these interesting ideas. The court really is doing some, or at least several of the justices are talking about ideas and introducing really radical theories and thinking in the court that we haven't seen for a very long time, and that's interesting and promising. We don't know where it'll lead, but it's from our perspective as objectivists. The last one is how did freedom fare, and I'll try to sum that up toward the end without handicapping the discussion. So with that, let me turn it over to Larry, and we're going to talk about Hawaii versus Trump.
Sure. I want to talk first about the so-called travel ban case. I do want to comment on what you said. I think looking at a Supreme Court term, it can have the feel of a ping pong match. I think that's the way it is when you watch CNN or when you watch organizations talk about a Supreme Court term. You know, there's a bad case on abortion, there's a good case on speech, there's a good case on criminal procedure, there's a bad case on privacy. It's hard to know what to make of it, and I think what's important is the fundamental. I think as objectivists, we're looking to what degree did a term advance government toward a view that government is limited to its constitutional powers for the purpose of protecting individual rights. And so I think that's the lens through which Steve and Amy and I look at these cases. And a lot of what's interesting to us as activists who are trying to advance that view in the courts is more than just the results of the cases, which can be ambiguous or hopeful or disastrous. But we are sometimes looking for these expressions by members of the court where are they putting back in play old doctrines, old ideas, old precedents that have favored the enemies of the Constitution or the enemies of individual rights? Are they doing things that are new and maybe give us work for the next 5 years, saying, well, where do we want to double down on this? Where do we want to bring our next series of cases? What strategically do we have to do to position our issues to get to the court? And so that's kind of the way we look at it. When we talk about the Hawaii versus Trump case, I think this is actually a pretty simple case that didn't make a tremendous amount of law. It's often called a travel ban case. You may recall that the President Trump issued three different executive orders that were sort of in play at various phases of this litigation. In the end, the court is looking, in the Supreme Court case, at the third of these. A week after he takes office, he issues this order that suspends entry of foreign nationals from a range of countries. I think there were eight or nine originally, for 90 days, presumably so the Department of Homeland Security could investigate the security apparatus of those countries, the way that they communicated with the United States about nationals coming into our country. He just wants to put a hold on it. Some of his rhetoric was pretty extreme, you know, a total ban on Muslims entering the United States until we figure out what's going on, I think was the quote that he used over and over in rallies. The case that makes it to the Supreme Court is the one that came out of Hawaii, where the state of Hawaii, three individuals, and a community group of Muslims in Hawaii sued. And what they said was this suspension on foreign nationals coming into the United States violates two things. One was a statute. They said the president exceeded his authority under the Immigrant and Nationality Act, Immigration and Nationality Act. And second, they had this interesting argument that it violated the First Amendment rights, the ability of U.S. citizens with family members overseas. It violated their either free expression rights or their establishment clause rights. So that somehow the government was favoring one religion over another by keeping people from these countries out of the United States. What I found interesting about the case, I mean, we'll get to the issues, is this whole thing had an air of panic about it. And I think that's partly the way the president implemented it. 1 week after he comes into office with a tremendous amount of sort of anti-Muslim rhetoric, the courts immediately jump on him. There are three or four cases coming up in the trial courts, people suing in various areas, and the trial courts coming out with decisions that are not well-reasoned, that have national injunctions. So they're saying, you know, not only are the parties coming to my court secure from this order, but it can't be enforced anywhere in the nation. That's quite unusual. Justice Thomas has some things to say about that that we'll talk about in the case. It puts pressure on all the courts then to handle the problem very quickly. So, you know, it goes from trial court to appellate court to the Supreme Court, three versions of this all within, I think, about a year. So it's just a very unusual situation that injected a lot of panic into the situation, you know, partly because of the president, partly because of the media and the activism pressure, partly just because I think courts were offended by it, were freaked out by it. They were acting very quickly. It was kind of unusual. So I just want to separate for about a minute the three versions of this because there are relevant differences. The first one, the first order that the president issued was to suspend entry of nationals from seven countries. It was Iran, Iraq, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, Syria, and Yemen. All of those countries were on a list before he came to office by Congress, who had identified those countries as posing heightened risks of terrorism to U.S. citizens. That's in some sense, how he got that list. The idea was we're going to suspend entry from those countries for 90 days while Homeland Security investigates how well their internal security agencies are vetting people who are coming to our country, whether or not they're willing to give us information about the people coming to our country. That was struck down. It was enjoined. And rather than fight about it too long, I mean, it did go to one appellate court in the Ninth Circuit, but rather than fight about it too long, he withdrew that order. The president withdrew that order and replaced it with a new one that again directed a worldwide review of all countries and how they are willing to share information about their citizens who are intending to come to the United States. It added to it something I think was important, which was case-by-case waivers of that suspension. Mm-hmm. So if you showed up and you said, well, I want asylum, or I have some particular threat against me, or I have a way of proving, even if my country isn't willing to share information, you could get special treatment, notwithstanding the ban. And then he added a long statement to it, this 12-page statement to show that the reason why he's choosing these countries is because of studies that have been done, congressional findings, that there is, in fact, heightened risk of terrorism in each of those countries. So he was trying to sort of backfill the justification to get away from his transparently anti-Muslim statements of earlier. That entry restriction also was sustained in effect in 90 days, and in fact, it ran that whole time. It was never, I think it might have been enjoined by one court, but the injunction was dissolved by the Fourth Circuit or one of the courts. In any event, it runs the whole time, and the president issues the final order, which is the one that gets subject in this decision. That order is interesting compared to the first, because it ended up placing entry restrictions on nationals from 8 countries, and it documented fairly thoroughly that each of those countries has systems for managing or sharing information about their nationals with the United States that were deficient. Either there were countries that were totally unwilling to give us information when we asked for it, or the integrity of their systems was quite bad. The countries ended up being Chad, Iran, Iraq, Libya, North Korea, Syria, Venezuela, and Yemen. So you see some of the sort of predominantly Muslim countries drop off the list, and other countries that are just basket cases for other reasons come on the list. At some point in time, this is relevant to the Supreme Court, Iraq comes off the list because 50 days after the order is promulgated, Homeland Security looks at it and they says, actually, Iraq has made strides. They're communicating with us better. They're cooperating with us against ISIS. It's easier for us to figure out and vet the people who are trying to come to the country. They added Somalia to the list and then changed it up so that only certain people from Somalia, certain categories of people, were restricted and not others. So it gives this air of, we have a suspension on entry based on reasons we've discovered over this 90-day review period. We're adding countries that we didn't know the first time around were a problem based on that review. We're taking some of them off based on what we're finding. We're adding sort of flexibility into the law so that there's some way for people to get in, even from those banned countries. And I think the court looked at all of that, and then with the text of the Immigration and Nationality Act, and it seemed fairly easy for them to conclude that the president was acting within his authority granted to him by Congress under this statute. And I think it's worth reading the text of that act, at least the relevant portion, to see just how broad the president's authority is under the act of Congress. It says, quote, whenever the president finds that the entry of any aliens or any class of aliens into the United States would be detrimental to the interests of the United States, he may by proclamation, and for such period as he shall deem necessary, suspend the entry of all aliens or any class of aliens or immigrants, or impose on the entry of aliens any restrictions he may deem to be appropriate. The court, I think, read that, looked at what he had done, and concluded pretty simply that this act, quote, exudes deference to the president in every clause. You know, it's all aliens for any purpose he deems necessary, when he finds. And, you know, whatever his animus was at the beginning, the process that the administration went through to ultimately justify the order passes muster. And it's interesting to me that the dissent in this case, you know, it was a 5-4 decision, the dissent in this case really does not raise any issue with his authority under the statute. I mean, they basically have to accept that, yeah, he didn't violate the statute. There was a kind of second argument they made that was a red herring, or at least the majority found it was a red herring, that there's a part of the Immigration and Nationality Act that says nationality can't be a reason for excluding aliens, which seems odd. They pressed this argument very hard, but it turns out it's just a kind of rank misreading of the statute. There's a difference between people entering the country and granting of visas. You can't discriminate on the basis of nationality when issuing visas. You can when suspending entry, so they pretty quickly dispense with that.
Can I interject one question for you right here? I just want to make sure the audience understands really as crystal clearly as we can make it, what is the real issue in this case? What's going on in this case? Because if you listen to the debates out there, it's something like, is Trump horrible or is he only slightly horrible? I mean, that's not really what's going on. Or on the other side, are immigrants horrible and should we prevent all immigration? But that's not, the public debate is very different from what is actually happening in the Supreme Court. So the way I would put the issue in the immigration case is, it comes down to this: to what extent does the president have discretion to decide questions of immigration in general? And then in this case, it's slightly even narrower, it's a bit narrower. I would put it as, to what extent does he have discretion to make immigration decisions when national security is at issue? And does the court have the ability to, and this is often a way it's put in kind of general debates about this, but I think it's accurate to think about it like this, to second guess those decisions. And does the court, you know, what is the role of the court in reviewing a presidential decision on immigration that has implications for national security? My own personal view of the immigration order is that it's stupid, arbitrary, probably has something to do with religious discrimination. That's less clear. My view of the case and the ruling that they issued is it's definitely right. Now, those are two very different things. I'm not a fan of the order that he implemented. I think the decision is absolutely correct, but the reason for that, and we can all disagree about that, people can have different views on this, but the reason I think that is, I think the president has to have very broad discretion to make decisions about immigration in connection with national security. And in any event, one of the things that, and I made this point earlier, you have to think about the other branches. The language that Larry just read, that Congress delegated this authority to the president, is incredibly broad. It is incredibly broad. It basically says you can do anything you want in immigration if you think there's a, what, it's a national, you know, national, it's not even national security purpose, it's in the national interest. You make whatever decisions you want as long as it's in the national interest. That is as broad a grant of authority to the president as you can imagine. One could argue that Congress should not be able to delegate that authority to the president. That's a valid argument.
Right.
It is, at this point, I think foreclosed by Supreme Court precedent, but that would be a really good argument to make. And I might agree, yeah, Congress shouldn't be able to delegate that. But that was not at issue in this case. So when people criticize the Supreme Court, oh, you're allowing Donald Trump to get away with, you know, infusing our immigration laws with hatred of Muslims, which in itself is a fuzzy issue and needs to be examined, that's not what's going on. And we have to remember one thing. Congress delegated this authority to the president. You know,
and
if you want
to take it back.
Yeah, that's right. And if you want, and so those, whether it's people here, outside, you know, in the world at large, who find what Trump is doing repugnant, you need to focus on what Congress did to empower a repugnant president to do what he's doing. Now, I'm not even convinced that what he did, if you look at the face of this order, is repugnant. I think Trump is repugnant. I think that his ideas are inexplicably bizarre, but you know, you just can't really understand what his motives are. But even if that's true, the question here comes down to, in essence, it's a question of what is the role of the courts and how much authority should they exert to second guess what the president does. And if you put it in the context of, imagine an order like this issued right after 9/11 that barred all immigration from the entire Middle East except Israel for a period of, you know, a year, just because we got to sort things out. There'd be a really good argument that that was religious discrimination, and I would say absolutely the president has to be able to do that. So, I mean, but if you're going to think of the rules that the court issues, you've got to think about them not in the easy cases when, you know, nothing really is happening from a national security standpoint, or at least we're not as focused on it. You have to think about, okay, what's the ruling in a really hard case? Because what they're doing is they're issuing a rule, and it's not just a rule that applies to this case, it's a rule that applies to all similar cases. Anyway, I've taken up a lot.
No, that's great. I mean, I think...
I just want to make sure we really understand exactly what the issue is, and we think hard about that issue. I mean, the audience is...
Yeah, the structure of the case as it comes to the court is not whether the policy is good or bad, or whether his statements or tweets were good or bad. The question is, what authority did Congress delegate the president? What did he do in implementing that authority? And their conclusion is pretty straightforward, that it seems like the president did more than he had to do under this broad delegation of authority by Congress in order for it to pass muster. And I think maybe he should have done more than he had to do, because his actions were surely tainted by tweets and crazy statements going up. So I think it's totally proper that they questioned him on it and made sure that he did at least what he had to do under the statute without rubber stamping it. But that was their conclusion. He did everything he had to do, given this enormously broad delegation of authority over suspending entry of aliens that was granted to the president by Congress. You know, they came up, the next major issue that comes up for the plaintiffs in this case is a constitutional one, because they're going to lose, I think they probably knew they were going to lose under the statutory argument, so they raise this Establishment Clause argument. And that's interesting, too. You know, whose rights are at stake? The plaintiffs said that their First Amendment rights had been violated, and so you know, we say their rights, whose rights, and what rights. It's not the immigrants or the foreign nationals that would be coming to the country whose rights were violated. It's the way the case was pitched by the plaintiffs is plaintiffs were U.S. residents who had family members overseas, and they were arguing that the government was somehow establishing a religion or violating their religious rights by having animus against their family members who would come. So it was sort of the inability for them to get connected with their family members. It was the U.S. citizens' rights that were at issue in this case. The First Amendment provides, to kind of remember, is Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. That's the part of the First Amendment that they said is being violated. And the argument here is that the Establishment Clause has lots and lots of time been held to mean the government can't discriminate among religions in its activities, can't prefer one religious denomination or another. So if you get a president of the United States standing up and saying, I'm going to have a total ban on Muslims in the United States until we figure out what's going on, that sure sounds like religious discrimination. The plaintiffs are alleging that the primary purpose of this executive order was animus towards religion. That statement is crazy. I wrote it down here again. It's actually a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States, is what he said it was. But the majority of the court thought that there were two things that were important here. First, the actual executive order that was under review, the third version of it, well, any versions of it, but certainly by the third version, was totally neutral to religion by its terms. So at least the four corners of the document has no religious animus in it. It never mentions religion. And by the time they get to the third version with all this study that's done, it's hard to see how it's directed uniquely against Muslims, according to the majority, when, for instance, Christians from Somalia are equally banned as much as Muslims coming from Somalia. North Korea is on the list, but Indonesia, which is predominantly Muslim, is not. They make the point that something like 8% of the world's Muslim population is covered by these banned countries. So Venezuela is now included, and so it starts to feel more like, yeah, maybe all these countries are aligned not just because they're Muslim, but because their governments are in disarray and they really can't control the people coming in and out of their borders. They're not available to provide information to the United States when we ask them about their foreign nationals. That weighed very heavily for the majority, that you know there, it was neutral on its face, and it had all of this indicia of something more objective than animus against Muslims. Mm-hmm. And second, the court didn't want to go into a deep scrutiny of the motives behind the four corners of the document because it thought there was a separation of powers issue here, that the Constitution, as well as the congressional delegation, charges, or the delegation of power by Congress, charges the president with national security. And the court just does not want to get into the business of second-guessing the president's judgments, particularly after he goes through the work of making all these findings and tasking an administrative agency to investigate every country in the world and come up with a report. They look at that and they say, yeah, if we thought the only reason or predominant reason was animus against Muslims or discriminating against one religion or another, that's one thing, but here seems like something different, and the separation of powers precludes us from getting too much into it if it's not just a palpable violation of the Constitution. It's interesting, the majority actually does get behind the text of the order. I mean, it does investigate. That's, I mentioned a minute ago, it comes up with this number, 8% of the Muslim populations are affected in these countries. But they look at it in the end, they think the emphasis is on provisions protecting national security and based on a fairly objective and reasonable list of criteria that the mm-hmm. Department of Homeland Security set out. So in the end, their answer is something like, yeah, it's, they have a lot of language chastising the president in the opinion, too. So, you know, it's unfortunate that the president talks the way he does, but what he's actually done is within his powers that Congress has given him, within the charge that he has the separation of powers under the Constitution, and we don't think there was any discrimination against U.S. citizens by this, so there's no First Amendment violation.
Yeah, let me just ask both of you guys a question on these later last two points that you covered. So, that one of the issues in the case, which is kind of implicit in the decision, is does the First Amendment, let's say, or the Establishment Clause, so establishing religion, to what extent does it even apply to non-citizens? And is that argument even credible? I have serious questions about that, and I want to know what you guys think of it. But also the whole issue of evidence of motive, so when you think, you know, it's Trump's tweets, but that idea, that you could even call it religious bigotry, I don't know, I think that's problematic because we're talking about religion, which is a philosophy, and it's relevant to how people act. Mm-hmm. So I think that really is, we need to have, you know, there has to be hard thinking on this, which there is none of this in this country today, about to what extent is it entirely valid to, you could put it as discriminate against a religion, but you have to think about it as discriminate against an ideology that is motivating people and countries to engage in wholesale murder violence and slaughter of people. I mean, it just can't be put as the same thing as whether the Ten Commandments goes in the public park. That's a bit different than we're importing large numbers of people who want to murder large numbers of people in this country, not, you know, the least of which is things that like happen on 9/11. There's a connection between those two things. And read Alon's books on this point. On the ideology that's kind of coupled with the religion of Islam. It's a hard question. So one question is, to what extent do you guys think the Establishment Clause, or you could put it as the First Amendment, even should apply in a case like this? I'm not positive that it should, and I don't know that I really buy the argument that because individuals are residing in this country and they're Muslims and they think that precluding other Muslims would be establishing all other religions in essence. I mean, there's an argument to that, but there's a real problem, in my view, with applying the First Amendment to people who are non-citizens or applying it in a case like this, and I'm wondering what you guys think, because I'm really skeptical that it should apply in the normal way that it would apply if you were dealing with people who are in the country and the kind of typical case that we see.
Yeah, I agree with you. On its face, the First Amendment might apply to everyone. It directs Congress to make no law. It doesn't really say much about others, and there might be other parts of the Constitution, the Due Process Clause of the 5th and the 14th Amendment, which speak about persons, not citizens. Maybe they have a right to travel that shouldn't be abridged. That would be a very different case than the one that's brought up. You know, again, the posture of the case matters. The court was dealing with this very particular question about what the president's authority was under this particular statute and whether it affects the Establishment Clause. But the court didn't decide this. And I think it would be an interesting question. I think it's probably true that foreigners have some standing in U.S. courts.
They should. I mean, because, you know, one question is, should the Constitution be interpreted in such a way that they do? And then the second question is, should a constitution of a proper society protect the rights not just of citizens or legal residents, you know, people who are here versus the people, they are still people, they still have rights, right? So perhaps part of the problem is perceiving a conflict or, you know, a call to balance rights where there really aren't two rights in conflict. So, you know, certainly you don't have any sort of, you know, freedom to practice a religion just by calling it a religion that has you actively engaged in an attempt to commit violent acts against our citizens. So, you know, there shouldn't be a conflict between those things such that you could say, oh, well, therefore their rights under the Establishment Clause is a claim against us taking proper security measures to protect American citizens. I would say in a proper government, they would have just as much claim to rights under Establishment Clause or, you know, the equivalent as anybody else should. But then whether that would apply in a particular situation, no, you know, you don't have free speech if you're shouting fire in a crowd. Exactly. Right. Yeah.
Well, I think the extreme version of that, though, is if the president had simply come out with a proclamation that said, because Muslims are a danger to us, they're not permitted in the country. That was in the four corners of the document. I think there'd be no question that the court would have struck that down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that represents animus toward a particular religion. Wasn't the case.
But I think also that statement wouldn't be complete enough in terms of establishing the objective security risk, right? So it's not all Muslims, it's some subset of Muslims, and then the work has not been done to even, you know, objectively, certainly not by our government, identify which subset of Muslims and how you would sort that out and stuff. But, you know, the fact that perhaps all Muslims would have to undergo more scrutiny in order to figure out which subset of Muslims it is that should be excluded, that's something that we'd need to be willing to do, and an establishment clause shouldn't get in the way of doing that, right?
Yeah, I think I'm with you, Steve. It's a funny place for the establishment clause. It always seemed like a stretch to me that these citizens' religious rights were somehow abridged because some of their family members couldn't come over. There's no sense in which we're establishing a religion on that basis. And in any event, there might be legitimate circumstances in which religion would be a legitimate factor when looking at foreign nationals. You could create a situation where people begin defining themselves as a church, and the church's precepts include some attack on Western civilization in order to gain protection by the Establishment Clause. It seems like a stretch. I mean, the fact that you're establishing a religion by keeping out people that you've objectively determined have some threat to you, it's the wrong clause.
Yeah, that's the ultimate issue, is you have to distinguish between focusing on people who are a threat and for particular reasons versus going after a religion or speech or something like that. It's a difficult issue. So ultimately, I'm going to move on to the next case now because we've taken a lot of time on this, but it's an important case and people can ask us questions about it. I would call this one as really neutral in terms, I mean, it's important on freedom, but it's mostly important to understand this ruling from the standpoint of the rule of law and the proper role of courts. And I think ultimately the court did the right thing, even though I'm not a fan of Trump at all, and I'm a fan of open immigration, but I recognize there are all kinds of difficulties in dealing with national security issues. So with that last word now, Amy, on the Carpenter case.
Okay. Well, I just want to say briefly, thanks for inviting me to fill in. I was looking forward to hearing what Ankar had to say about these cases myself. I was going to be sitting out there. I hope he and his family are doing well. I am happy to be able to talk about Carpenter. Many of you know that I've been involved, not so much, I'm not a Fourth Amendment expert per se, but I've been very focused on privacy issues in my research for a very long time. And in particular, there is this arcane sounding doctrine called the third party doctrine that comes squarely at issue in Carpenter. Carpenter, for those of you who don't know, this is the case that involved what's called cell service location information. And that is information that cell phone companies collect. They're not required to, but they collect and store information about when and under what circumstances you connect to a cell tower in order to get certain types of service, data, phone calls, et cetera. And in this case, the government obtained significant quantities of that data about Carpenter, and as a result of that, the government was able to prosecute him and convict him of robbery, violent robbery. So that's the context. Because there was not a warrant issued in order for the government to get that information, he challenged the obtaining of that information on Fourth Amendment grounds, saying that it was, in the words of the Fourth Amendment, a search. And so this ends up being the issue that's presented to the court. Was there a search for purposes of the Fourth Amendment when the government obtained this cell service location information from a couple of the cell service providers?
And so what is the Fourth Amendment? Just remind everybody.
Okay, so the Fourth Amendment says people have the right to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects, free from unreasonable searches and seizures. So what has ended up, the question presented to the court ends up being phrased very narrowly. They just want to know, was there a search in this case for purposes of the Fourth Amendment? And, to get to the punchline, the court ended up saying, yes, there is a search. And in fact, in a case like Carpenter's, in which the court obtains at least 7 days worth of cell service location information, where they get all the information about how many times and in what circumstances you connected to different various cell towers around. You guys understand that technology, by the way? So each tower has these pies that come out from it. Maybe there's 3 or 4 different antennas. And so it will say, okay, you connected to this particular tower on the corner of, First and Maine or whatever, and you, not only that, you connected, say, to a particular antenna that goes out at a certain angle, so there's some pie wedge where they could place you at that point in time, and that's how they found out that he was near the locations of the robbery.
Sort of indirect surveillance state mechanism, kind of. You can track people and figure out where they were through looking at cell phone records, but it's after the fact, right?
After the fact, and in fact, that's one of the things that the court cites. But to give you the punchline, the court did rule, you know, in favor of Carpenter and said, yes, it's a search. The court needs a warrant based on probable cause and particularized suspicion when it obtains this information, at least on a 7-day or longer interval. So that sounds pretty good, right? You'd say, okay. And in fact, I'll talk about the third-party doctrine in a second, but this is actually the first time that the court has said, we're not going to extend this doctrine any further, or maybe we're going to put a limitation on this doctrine. So it sounds really good. The government's told, you know, in the hashtag, get a warrant. And in fact, Edward Snowden was out tweeting that this was a significant victory for privacy because the court was told to get a warrant in this case.
So what does it mean, sorry to keep interrupting, sure. I just want to make sure everybody, I'm also ignorant of this area, so I'm asking questions that I can't remember myself from law school, but
sure.
I mean, what's the, why is it even significant whether the government gets a warrant versus doesn't? I mean,
In this case, what did happen is they did get an order. There was an order, but it was pursuant to the so-called Stored Communications Act. And I've written down the standard. What they have to do to get an order under the Stored Communications Act is give specific and articulable facts which provide reasonable grounds to believe that the information they're going to get is relevant and material to an ongoing criminal investigation. Mm-hmm. So that is not probable cause, it's reasonable grounds, which is something lower than that. And moreover, there is not particularized suspicion pointing to this one person. It's just this relevance standard. So it's a much lower standard.
Yeah. So it's something like having evidence, so probable cause would be evidence about that guy who committed a crime. And then saying, okay, we have a good reason to haul him off to prison because at least, or at least to we have probable cause to arrest him, let's say, because, you know, there's real evidence about him. And a judge then intervenes, or they take it to the judge, and the judge says, yeah, this is an objective look at this. I think there's real evidence here. As opposed to, you know, he was in the vicinity, and maybe there was, you know, he could be connected to a crime.
Right.
Kind of looks a little bit suspicious. So, you know, I mean, that's really what we're talking about. It's having a court, and this is really important historically, it's having a court step in and put a check on the executive branch, on the police, mm-hmm. and say, we're going to have an objective analysis of this. Everybody calm down. We're going to look at the evidence, and I'm going to make a decision about whether there's sufficient evidence for you to screw around with this guy's life, as opposed to just, you know, we can see some broad connection here. We can come up with some kind of a circumstantial case. So haul him off to prison along with the usual suspects. Keep him in jail for a while.
Yeah, and I mean, this is even more preliminary because it's, you know, make a certain showing before you can even conduct a search.
Yeah. Right.
You know, whatever a search is. And so, you know, what the Fourth Amendment will say, once you have a search, it has to be reasonable, which... Mm-hmm. presumably, you know, to them was, it has to be a warrant based on that high level mm-hmm. of probability, probable cause, and again, particularized suspicion. So it sounds great, right? It sounds great for your freedom. So if you have a cell phone right now, you feel more free, right? Because the government cannot get your information quite as easily after this ruling. And I would say, well, sort of for a little while, I disagree with Snowden. Snowden's let me down a couple times in the last year or so because he's calling for regulation of Facebook, which I think that there's no greater way to invite 1984 than to have the government start getting its hands in Facebook. But also, I was disappointed with this. I do not think this is a major victory, and let me tell you why. I don't think it's a coincidence that the majority opinion was written by Justice Roberts, who also gave us Obamacare's attacks. What he did here, even though he went ahead and wrote an opinion that provided that the court, you know, the government does have to get a warrant in a situation like this, The grounds on which he did so are very narrow and pragmatic. And some of you might be familiar in the area of Fourth Amendment law that the definition of a search ever since the 70s in the case called Katz has been based on what's called a reasonable expectation of privacy. A search has occurred if the government has invaded something in which you have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And what the majority, in an opinion written by Roberts, 5-4, has done in this case is double down on that standard. I've written an entire paper called Pragmatism and Privacy in which I dissect it, and I'll refer you there. But this is a very pragmatic standard.
Why is that?
Reasonable expectation of privacy. So what it requires...
So what
it requires is, on the one hand, that you actually have an expectation of privacy. That's in the original formulation. It required that, yes, you actually do have an expectation of privacy. And then secondly, here's the pragmatist part. Is it an expectation that society is prepared to recognize as reasonable? That society is prepared. And the way that I understand this in pragmatist speak is because of my reading of James. And I always go back to this one quotation from James.
William James.
William James wrote in one of his essays on ethics that the good is simply to satisfy demand. And if you are trying to, you know, for instance, be someone in government, your goal would be to satisfy as many demands as you can at a time. So what you have in this reasonable expectation of privacy test is you have, on the one hand, the individual demanding privacy in a certain realm, and then against that you have society demanding information about that individual for security or for law enforcement or other types of purposes. And this has been the test, reasonable expectation of privacy. It's not tied, for example, to whether there has been a trespass to an area of your property in which you keep private things. It's not objective in that sense. It's this balancing.
Can I ask you some questions that concretize that a little bit?
Sure, sure.
Think of it like, I think I'm right about this, but you tell me if I'm wrong. So another way to think about the sort of social standard that Amy thought about, and oftentimes I think this comes up in the cases, it's in essence, what would most people think is a violation of their privacy? And then the court sort of tries to assess that. And you get
that
cases,
will have to do with the actual expectation.
But you get to cases where, I mean, I remember there was a case not too long ago where didn't they put the tracking device on the car
in someone's driveway? So that's U.S. v. Jones. That's U.S. v. Jones,
and it was in their driveway, right?
Yeah. I mean, it doesn't really matter where it was, actually, for purposes of the ruling. And, you know, that case is very relevant to why I believe that this is actually not a great victory for privacy. So let me... I'll say why here. This decision reinforces this reasonable expectation of privacy rubric. And what Justice Scalia had been doing before he passed away is walking away from that, you know, this idea of reasonable expectation of privacy as the touchstone for whether there has been a search for purposes of the Fourth Amendment. He was seeking something more concrete and objective. And so he was going back to the language of the Fourth Amendment. What does it protect? Persons, houses, papers, and effects. And in fact, you know, your persons, houses, papers, and effects. And there was a case called Kyllo, K-Y-L-L-O, in which focused on a home. The government had trained a heat-seeking device at a home, and they decided, okay, there's a search for purposes of the Fourth Amendment when they used this technology to get the information that could not otherwise be gotten but for a physical search, right? That's one. And then 2012, United States versus Jones, this is 1 year before the Snowden revelations, the court ruled that if the government puts a GPS device on a car, that is a search for purposes of the Fourth Amendment. Why? Because it is a trespass to your vehicle, which is an effect. It's an effect for purposes of the Fourth Amendment. What I saw in my work is that this was a very promising line of reasoning from Justice Scalia because it was starting to recognize once again, because we've had this in the past, a property-based understanding of privacy. Up until an Olmsted dissent by Justice Brandeis way back in early 1900s, up until then, very solidly, the court would tie whether there had been a search to the question of whether there had been a physical trespass. And slowly, from Olmsted up until Katz in the 1970s, that was eroding. And then finally, with Katz, they said, "Nah, it's gone. You know, reasonable expectation of privacy. Let's not be tied to property."
Yeah. So the again, just to I just want to make sure it's really crystal clear to people. If you think about the analysis, is something like this: yeah, it's your car. You own that car. We are in essence trespassing into that car by putting a device on it. But the real question should be whether most people have a, quote, expectation of privacy with respect to their car. Now,
and not just whether they have the expectation, but whether it's one that society is prepared to recognize
that's what
as reasonable.
Say, right?
Yeah, so there's that normative evaluation that
they do. Yeah, and one answer to that is get the hell off my property. It's my car. And I mean, I mean that that's what's missing from this whole debate, and that's, I think, part of what you're talking about is...
Get a warrant to get on my car.
Well, that's right. Yeah, exactly. So, so go to court and get a warrant if you are going to, quote, trespass on my property. Mm-hmm. If you don't have that standard, property rights, you can have all kinds of questions about, well, what about your garbage can? Well, what if they cross your property? Well, what about your driveway? Well, what about that space between your house and the other house? Well, what about behind your house? Well, I don't know. Do most people think that behind the house has a, you know, is private as opposed to the side of the house, as opposed to in front of the house? And one easy way, clear, really bright line rule would be to say, this is my property. If you're coming on my property, you have to get a warrant.
Right.
It should be, you know, obvious that I expect privacy on my own property. So get the hell off, get a warrant. That's a nice bright line rule. Once you lose property rights and you throw that standard in the garbage and we get to this fuzzy expectation of privacy, it's like the court is, you know, what does society think about this today?
Yes.
Well,
yes.
It's a mess. And so, and you get, I mean, there are many other reasons for this, I think, the drug laws, other things, but that's really what's at stake here.
And so then, so let me tell you why you should not be excited and why I don't think Snowden should be excited about what happened in Carpenter. It's because even though the majority ruled in favor of Carpenter, what Roberts does in this opinion is he applies United States versus Jones, that wonderful, what I think, you know, was a continuation of this great trend that Scalia was starting, going back and looking at a property focus, and he recharacterizes it as being primarily about the type of information that was gathered by the court. Again, going back to this, you know, what do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in? Oh, well, in Jones, it was that there was all this location information about you that the government had obtained without a warrant. He does say, very matter-of-factly in one sentence in the opinion, Roberts, it was decided on trespass grounds. But then he just bypasses that and characterizes United States versus Jones as if it's primarily about the type of information that was gathered. So United States versus Jones, it was location information, and here it's location information. It's not as precise, but wow, it's over a long period of time, and it's going to be more precise. The technology's getting better all the time. So in fact, what the court did is they decided that they would walk back a long-standing doctrine, this third-party doctrine. I want to explain it in a second. They'll walk it back simply because this type of information is supposedly so important, it's so private about you. So let me tell you a little bit about this third-party doctrine. So the third-party doctrine, it's a Fourth Amendment doctrine that was created by the Supreme Court, and it says that once you share information with a third party, so it could be your cell service provider, Facebook, other types of social media, your bank, regular landline phone company, all of those people, once you share information with them, that information no longer has Fourth Amendment protection because you are said to no longer have a reasonable expectation of privacy in it. This doctrine, contrary to what any of the justices talk about in here, this doctrine predated the 70s. In the 1970s, this doctrine was applied to all of our personal information that we share with third parties through two cases, Smith and Miller. Smith and Miller involved your telephone records. In that case, it was just phone numbers that you had dialed from your house. I guess maybe the time of day at which you did it as well. That's all they could get then. They get so much information from us now, the phone companies. And then second, banking records in Miller. Those were the two types of information. But in the 1970s, they took that Katz doctrine, do you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in this stuff? And they said, no. Insofar as the banking industry, it's subject to regulation and reporting requirements. Even in the 1970s, the banks were already having to turn over information about you to the U.S. government. There was regulation. Phone companies, they figured, oh, well, you know, the telephone number you dial, that's just metadata, as they like to call it. So the third-party doctrine has said that pretty much without challenge all the way up until now. And here's the first time that they have to consider it. You know, what do they want to do with this third-party doctrine? And it turns out that Carpenter, argued for by the ACLU, did not challenge the doctrine entirely, didn't call for Smith or Miller to be overturned. Mm-hmm. They didn't, you know, challenge this doctrine at all. And instead, he was just saying, well, somehow cell service location information is different. And sure enough, in all the dissents, there were actually four dissents in this case. Kennedy, Alito, Thomas, and then also Gorsuch was interesting. But they all dissented. And all of them made fun of the majority, trying to draw this distinction between your banking records, for example. Imagine the government being able to get all this transaction information, all the things that you spent your money on, with whom, for long periods of time, and trying to argue that your location information for 7 days is somehow more private or more revealing than that information. Mm-hmm. It doesn't even seem plausible. So what does the majority do? As I said, they go back towards this reasonable expectation of privacy standard. They do so in a way that's pretty implausible. They're trying to draw this distinction and tell courts somehow your location information, 7 days or longer, is more revealing, more private, more intimate than is all these banking records and everything else that they are not touching. So they ruled very narrowly. And as I said, at the same time, they walked back, they undermined, you know, you talk about trends. Trends was one of the things you talk about. One of the promising trends I had seen in the court was this property-based rationale for privacy. People can go, you know, read and look at all of my work about this. So I think you get a little bit more privacy for a limited period of time. In the meantime, this is a ruling that has all sorts of balancing factors and things that make it very difficult for future courts to apply. It also makes it difficult, let's not forget, the job of law enforcement. What does law enforcement think they can do without obtaining a warrant after Carpenter in terms of obtaining information about you? All they know is bank records, traditional telephone data, okay. Cell service location information, GPS. They have a couple of concrete examples, but then, you know, what if the thing that they're trying to get about you is your Facebook messages or something? Apples, oranges, and what? You know, how do you figure out what that is? And so I would say you think you're a little more free because the government has to get the warrant for the location information, but maybe not so much because the underlying rationale that in the long term is going to protect our privacy has been undermined. And at the same time, in the meantime, law enforcement, which helps to make us more free insofar as they're able to do their job and know what they're permitted and what they're not, they're being prevented from doing that properly. The promising things in here, you can ask Q&A or whatever. I really did like Gorsuch's dissent. Believe it or not, Gorsuch dissented while at the same time saying that he thought there was a promising property-based rationale for upholding the view that Carpenter, you know, that they should have had a warrant to get Carpenter's information. Gorsuch actually comes sort of close to my theory, which is that eventually you should get rid of the third-party doctrine and handle all this under property or contract-based concepts.
Good. So property rights matter. Yeah, I'm going to go to about three, and then we'll do questions after that. So,
okay.
I want to cover. I'm going to take on three cases and briefly describe what happened in each of them. But the basic, I think, way to think about the following three cases is how is intellectual freedom faring in the Supreme Court? Overall, the answer is really well or surprisingly well. And people can ask me questions about ways in which it's not quite good. But the three cases I want to talk about are the so-called gay wedding cake case. So we're going to do gay wedding cakes, unions, and pregnancy centers. Those are the next three cases to talk about. It's the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, which I think probably everybody here is familiar with. The second case, a case called Janus versus AFSCME, which is a union case, and it involves the question of whether unions or states can compel you to pay for union dues against your will. And then the final case, NIFLA, it's National Something Something Family Rights. I can't remember exactly what it stands for, but it's NIFLA, I think, versus the state of California. But ultimately, what the issue there is that there are these clinics that are, you could think of them as competing with Planned Parenthood, but from a anti-abortion standpoint, so that they are counseling people on alternatives to abortion. And the state of California imposed these disclosure requirements on them that essentially required them to advertise the fact that you can go get an abortion if you want to somewhere else. I mean, that's a really oversimplified version of the case. And the question is, does that impede the free speech rights of the pregnancy centers? But let me start with the Masterpiece Cake Shop. I mean, everybody, I think, knows essentially Christian Baker didn't want to bake a cake for a gay couple. He ran afoul of the Colorado civil rights laws, which essentially require or prohibit people from discriminating against others on the basis of sexual orientation, wide list religion, race, the kind of usual suspects of those kinds of laws. We did a whole video on this, so I'm going to keep my discussion of this case very brief. I encourage you to go watch the video. But the basic issue here is
on New Ideal.
New Ideal, yes, of course, on our new digital publication, New Ideal. This was Ankar Gatte, Alain Journeau, and I. We recorded this right after the argument, which was back in December. But anyway, the basic issue of this case is, can you compel a person against their deeply held religious beliefs? But you could think about it as moral beliefs, because it really wasn't. I mean, there was an establishment religious clause aspect to it, but it was solidly argued under the free speech it was the free speech clauses of the First Amendment. The idea was he's conveying his views or the state is trying to compel him to convey his views on a wedding cake when he doesn't want to do that. Or another way to think about it, and I think the better way to think about it, is the state is compelling somebody to take actions that he believes are immoral, that he is sanctioning or approving a ceremony that he disagrees with, and does the First Amendment allow that? Now, the court ultimately held, it basically punted on that issue. It didn't really decide the case. It decided that if there's some evidence of animus toward religion, then this sort of thing won't be allowed, that is, states won't be able to compel people to do this. But in essence, we reserve judgment on what happens later on if there is no religious animus. So one way you could put it is, the Supreme Court allows states to discriminate against people on the basis of their religion as long as they're not mean when they do it. And I think that's a fairly accurate way to put it, because it just kicks the can down the road. But there's a real issue of intellectual freedom here. And if we think about it from our perspective, from the objectivist perspective, it is that for real intellectual freedom to exist, you have to have the freedom not only to think for yourself and to speak your own, ideas and words to other people, but you have to have the freedom to act consistently with that. If you don't have the freedom to act consistently with that, what's the point of having free speech? What is the point of being able to try to convince people to convince people of ideas if they are not allowed to act on those ideas, or if you're not allowed to act on those ideas? You can think about Ayn Rand's quote, a free mind and a free market are corollaries. That's what she's getting at in that statement, and I encourage you to read the broader quote and, of course, the entire essay for The New Intellectual from which that comes. She's talking about the idea that rights are indivisible. If we have the right to life, we have to have the right to take the actions necessary to sustain our life. So that's really the issue in Masterpiece Cake Shop. Will someone have the right to take the actions that they think are proper and moral, even if they're completely wrong about that? And I think I think the baker is wrong, but I don't think this is as quite, I don't think this kind of thing rises to the level of, say, the civil rights disputes in the 60s, although people can ask why that is. But in any event, I would say, consistently people have to have the right to be, take the actions and to associate with whom they want, whether those are sensible decisions or really bad and horrible decisions. So yes, you should have the right to be a bigot and to disassociate yourself with other people because you're a bigot, and everybody can condemn you for it, and everybody can ostracize you for it. That's both sides of that equation are exercises of the right to association. Both sides of that equation are exercises of the right to intellectual freedom. If you don't have the freedom to either deal with the people that you want to deal with or not deal with the people you don't want to deal with, you don't really have freedom. And that's what was at issue in Masterpiece Cake Shop. The court did not decide that. Why didn't they decide it? There's a real simple reason for that. They were afraid to overturn the civil rights laws. I mean, this is we have a real conflict in our laws when we have laws that say, or a conflict between, or a conflict with the First Amendment, when we have laws that compel people to associate with one another. It's a real problem. And what it shows you is that, not surprisingly, the mainstream view does not understand Ayn Rand's view, and there are other thinkers who thought this in various ways, but she articulated it and made it clear in a way that was far better than anybody I've ever read in all of history, that they just don't get the connection between speech and action. And it's such a fundamentally important thing to get. So that's why the Masterpiece Cake Shop is an important case. What will happen in the future, it remains to be seen. Let me move to the second case, and I'll try to relate both of these to the issues I just discussed. I'm going to go a little bit over three, but I want to just get these two last points out. So the Janus case is a case that, as I said, allows public sector unions. A public sector union is simply a union of all of the civil service workers in a given state. In this case, I think it was Illinois. For a long time, the Supreme Court has held that public sector unions can compel people to pay for their collective bargaining activities. However, they can't compel people to pay for their political activities. Now, if you think about it, what a union does is it bargains on your behalf with the employer, right? So the whole idea is, if the unions are going to be representing people, and there's by law, once a union is representing a majority of the workers, all of the workers are represented, and there's really only one union in this, let's say it's the civil service workers or whatever, they are only allowed to have one union. And you can't opt out of having the union represent you. And so the issue is, can I be paid to, or can I be forced to pay for the union's activities on my behalf? Now, what the court classically said since the 1970s was, we'll kind of split the baby. Mm-hmm. We're going to force you to pay for collective bargaining activities, which are seen as somehow not raising issues of intellectual freedom or speech, but we won't force you to pay for their political activities. Now, there's a lot of problems that this raised since the 1970s, not the least of which is that unions find all kinds of ways around this, and they've managed to charge you a lot of money even and then spend it on political activities even when they say they're not. But it's still a fundamental question, and I think, again, the Janus case raises the question that we as objectivists should care about, which is, what does true intellectual freedom mean? And again, it's the issue of, can I be required, in this case it's to pay money to an organization that is then going to go and speak on my behalf, and does that not have an impact on my free speech or intellectual freedom? One of the really good things about this decision, the court came out, I think, the right way, although there are ways in which one can disagree with that, but I'm not going to go into those now. But one of the great things that the court did, if you've ever heard so I quoted Ayn Rand a minute ago, or at least a part of what she said in For the New Intellectual. Thomas Jefferson once said, and I think I have this quote basically right, but I might be paraphrasing a little, to compel a man to finance views that he abhors is sinful and tyrannical. Imagine if all of you were compelled to finance the Communist Party, or to compelled to finance anti-abortion groups, or, I mean, the church, or whatever. It doesn't matter. Or other people were compelled to finance objectivism. That would be a real problem. It is just as much a problem, in my view, to be compelled to finance the activities of even an organization that is just speaking on your behalf if you don't want them to speak on your behalf. Again, there is that connection between speech and action and you know, making things happen in the world. And the idea of association is that I should be able to associate with whomever I please and not associate with people. So that's the essential issue. The court, I think, the reasoning of the case is phenomenally good. It'll have a huge impact on public sector unions, and I think even private unions, because they're heavily regulated by the labor laws. Mm-hmm. So it's a momentous case. It'll be really interesting to see where this case goes. But the core of the court's reasoning, I think, is absolutely right and very, very important, and has implications way beyond the union context. Okay, the last case I'm going to talk about is the NIFLA case. So that's National Institute of Family Life Advocates versus Becerra. Becerra, I think, is the relevant official in California that that oversaw these laws. So essentially, it's this: there are these things called pregnancy centers, I think, throughout the nation, and they're set up by groups that oppose abortion. And the idea is they will provide counseling and various kinds of services, sonograms, other kinds of things for pregnant women, but not abortions. And then they're going to try to, I guess, convince women not to have abortions, or at least essentially say there's an alternative to having an abortion. And I think they're basically mostly Christian organizations and or clinics. California passed a law, and again, I'm vastly oversimplifying this, so I just want to make that clear, but I'm going to cut right to the heart of it. California passed a law that said these clinics have to have up on their wall a disclosure that says, if you want to get an abortion, here are all the places you can get an abortion, and here are the various state programs that you can get an abortion. And the idea was, or the I think the operation of the law was that this was a clear effort by the state of California to try to force clinics and organizations that are opposed to abortion to advertise for views that they find abhorrent and that they really disagree with. And so this case gets to the Supreme Court. It's a straight up, you're compelling us to essentially support ideas. In this case, it's not finance ideas, but actually put a label, you know, on our wall that supports ideas that we disagree with. Now, I'm pro-abortion. I'm pro-choice. I'm against what the, you know, ultimately, I think that it's great to have abortion clinics and widespread availability of abortion. But I am not in favor of the idea, and I think people who are principled about this should not be in favor of the idea that we can force people who disagree with that to essentially adopt or advertise a message that they disagree with. It has nothing to do, and the court drew a distinction between, you could think of, well, what about issues like malpractice, fraud, not telling, like if it would be a different circumstance if these pregnancy centers were pretending that they allowed abortion, drawing all of the women in that want to have an abortion, and then trying to convince them that they're not allowed to have abortions, or they shouldn't have abortions, or in some way, you know, pressuring them not to have abortions. That could be seen as fraud. That was not, as far as I can tell from the case, what was going on here. It was a clear effort by California to force people who disagree with abortion to advertise the opposite perspective. And again, the court ruled against the state and in favor of the pregnancy centers. And again, I think this is a real victory for intellectual freedom. And again, just to come back to the theme that I was hammering on before, real intellectual freedom means not just you get to think what you want to think, to say what you want to say, but to act consistently with that, so long as you don't violate people's rights. So that, you know, a law, you can't say, hey, I disagree with the murder laws and therefore I'm going to ignore those. But you can disagree with other people's perspectives, and you should not be forced to advertise positions that you find abhorrent. So in these three cases, we see in one case, the court punting and not deciding an important issue of intellectual freedom, I think because they were afraid of running afoul of the civil rights laws. In the other two, very much so. One of the interesting things to take a look at And if people want to ask us about Kennedy, obviously we'll talk about it. But when you're thinking about Supreme Court justices and factions on the court, it's interesting to note how the court sort of tiptoed through the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, but was very full-throated, at least the five justices and the conservatives, on the Janus case. Like that, to them, they thought clear violation of intellectual freedom. Masterpiece Cake, let's tiptoe around a little bit. I think the issue ultimately comes down to they're very afraid of overturning or leading, creating a line of precedent that could lead to overturning the civil rights law. So there's a real difficulty, you know, there's a conflict there. And I would say it's a conflict that one day will have to be resolved one way or another, but it's not going to be resolved now. Do you guys want to say anything?
Or? I think we better let people ask questions.
So why don't we go ahead and open it up for questions, and I hope people have... Oh, good.
Can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so there's a dispute about whether the court's ruling a Masterpiece, narrow, pragmatic, whether it makes it more likely that these state, local governments are going to get away with fining a baker who does this and stuff, and all they have to do is be nice about it.
Right.
Or whether it's really they just put off the question for another day and it's, you know, 0-0. You know, it's like going into overtime or something. It's all over again. It's fresh. What do you think?
I mean, I think it's both, really. I think if I were a state civil rights commission, I would just issue the exact same order holding Masterpiece Cake Shop, liable for violating those civil rights laws and not say much at all. On the face of it, you could just say they're discriminating against people based on their sexual preference, end of story, and just not say anything. So that's true, but I also think this issue, I mean, it's already coming back to the Supreme Court. People are already knocking on the door to get additional cases up there. So yeah, they're gonna have to confront this. It's a real issue. It's a hard issue, by the way. I don't mean to suggest that. I think it is a difficult issue to think about. I mean, because it puts you squarely in the territory of what do you do to solve things like, you know, segregation, Jim Crow laws. I mean, that was the whole issue that the courts and the country were deciding and really grappling with in the 50s and 60s, in the South. So, but anyway, let's go to questions. Shoot.
Hi, Dr. Peacock. It sounds like this is maybe a big area for you, and you probably have a lot of stuff written, so you might just refer me to your pieces, but I would love to get the basics on how to think about, I guess it sounds like this is the third-party doctrine, how to think about data that companies store on individuals and, you know, what they're allowed to do with it and what the government is allowed to ask for.
I have an entire paper that I published in St. John's Law Review. I also, thanks to Craig Biddle, published a shorter piece in the Objective Standard where I talk about the third-party doctrine and what I think should be done with it. In brief, again, my overall conception of privacy is that privacy should not be a distinct right, a separate right, but instead it is a state that we protect through exercising our property and contract rights. And there is a doctrine of common law contract that comes in and helps and solves this problem in a very unique way. And as I said, in Justice Gorsuch's dissent in Carpenter, where he talks about property doctrines and seems to be ready to look at implicit contracts and things, he seems to be ready to hear my solution. So that's the mystery, and I'm gonna have you go read, because it's quite technical and people have questions on other things. I don't wanna take up time. Thank you.
Yeah. Hi. So my question might actually be on the same thing. The whole time you were talking about the third-party doctrine and property rights as an alternative, I was thinking, how would property rights apply to things like cell phone data? Would they be the property of the cell phone user or the company?
So
how would that solve it?
You know, it's interesting because that's what the four dissents were really talking about, because they all believe that you should be looking at property. And that's why they dissented from the majority. The difference is that three of the dissenting justices thought that there was no property right. And Gorsuch was arguing that plausibly there might be a property right here. And he was arguing that there'd be some sort of an implicit contractual provision between you and your cell phone provider that would, in effect, give you at least some sort of a joint property interest in this data. Yes, they've created the record about you. You know, you don't go around keeping track of that sort of information, but they do for their own legitimate business purposes. And why not, for example, have some sort of an implicitly arising property right out of that, out of your contract? They have promises that they make in their contract not to disclose it to other private third parties. And the fact that they're making these promises to you with respect to what they're going to do with that data, you know, doesn't that start to give rise to an implicit contract, just like so many other implicit contracts? Gorsuch is willing to see that. Thomas and Alito and even Kennedy were saying, no, you know, we don't see any property interest here. So it could be done. Hopefully it will be.
Two questions and then I'll sit down. In the cake case, isn't the baker's business his property? And isn't the product of his services or the product of his ability his property?
Yes.
That's first. Second, on the case of seizure, search and seizure, and warrant, you think the Supreme Court will ever address the problem of judge shopping for warrants? Thank you.
Judge shopping for warrants. I am not a Fourth Amendment expert per se. As I said, my area is privacy. I'm certainly aware that there could be such a thing as judge shopping for warrants, but I don't know.
There definitely is such a thing. I'll say, as somebody who clerked in district court, there's no question that prosecutors go to judges and they wait to go before judges that they think are sympathetic to them. I don't see any way the Supreme Court could solve it unless, I mean, yeah, I don't really see it. It's one of those issues that I don't know if you can. I don't see any way that it ever gets to the Supreme Court because it's not really it's not a law. It's not even really an executive action. It's just, it's within the realm of prosecutorial discretion. And I mean,
And what is probable cause?
Yeah.
You know, there's judges will form a sense of that over time.
I mean, but you're going to try to. There is such a thing called forum shopping in the law, and it essentially means you try to go to forums that are going to be favorable to you as a lawyer. It's just part of the nature of how law works. It's unavoidable, and you know, I don't think there's really any solution to it. It's just an incidental aspect of the judicial system.
Right. But I think Amy maybe hit on it, which is that if you got the Supreme Court to articulate standards for probable cause that were more objective, and you reduced some of the bad doctrines, judicially created doctrines that insulate police prosecutors from any kind of personal liability when they lie on warrant applications or when they fudge things, I think that would begin to roll that back. But
Akil Amar wrote about this, right? Before the exclusionary rule, they used to be able to go after these guys for torts, and now the only remedy is exclusionary rule. So
In some sense, the form shopping or the judge shopping is just one of these habits that prosecutors get into when we have a few generations of not much liability for prosecutors that behave in pretty bad ways.
You know, more broadly, every litigant does this. It's part of that. So the solution to it, to the extent there's an actual problem, and it really depends on the context, is having good rules of law that are regularly issued or good rulings that are regularly issued by the Supreme Court. This is the point of the Supreme Court, to resolve these kinds of disputes. Next one.
Thanks. I'm going to ask about Justice Kennedy's retirement, and specifically, assuming that one of the people on President Trump's list gets confirmed and becomes the next Supreme Court justice, what you think the prospects are for abortion rights and potentially any other issues that immediately come to mind, assuming that shift in the court?
So why don't I just quickly start, and I'll say a handful of things. So, I mean, I don't have, the bottom line is this, the abortion is the big issue with Kennedy, I think, and it's because of that issue. But I mean, Kennedy affects other things because he is, you can think of him as the swing justice, although I don't really like the way, that just doesn't make sense to me because, you know, how you decide who is the swing justice, there are always four other justices on the side of the five justice majority. Why aren't all the rest of them swing justices? It's only because some of them are more predictable than Kennedy is, and he's got, you could put it as, a lot of people think of him as a pragmatist. He's got an interesting judicial philosophy, and it's one that takes him back and forth, and in many ways, I was talking, I don't know if it was you or others, that if you, it's possible that from our perspective, Kennedy is the best justice on the court, and he happens to jump back and forth in exactly the right decisions relative to all the others. But so I'll just leave that out as something to chew on. Don't fall into the rubric of left versus right, and Kennedy is somehow in the middle. It's not quite right, but it is definitely true that with Kennedy leaving the court, Roe and the right to abortion are there, in essence, up for grabs. And just to be very quick about it, I do think two things. You'll see, first, conservatives will definitely be gunning for Roe. This is absolutely positively going to happen. I mean, and second, it's probable that Trump will appoint a justice who would vote to overturn Roe. I'm just saying probable. I don't know enough about all the justices that are on the list to know what they think of it, but it's just more likely than not, I think. It's a question of whether Roberts would do that. I don't know if Roberts would. So even though you might not see Roe get overturned, I think what you'll almost definitely see, there are two ways they can do it. They could bring a case that just openly challenges Roe, or they can pass laws at the state level that erode Roe, which is already happening. And then the justices could uphold a lot of those kinds of laws that, it's death by a thousand cuts. But that's the big issue, is Roe. On other things, it's really hard to assess whether Kennedy leaving is worse rather than better. I mean, in general, I think he was a good justice, and I'm sorry to see him leave, but there are a lot of other things that, there are other issues that could be good.
Yeah, in Carpenter, for example, he was quite interesting because he was saying, look, I don't see a property interest in here. He actually thinks that the area should be adjudicated based on property interests. And he says, this is really just a straightforward application of Smith and Miller, and since you haven't challenged. So it was quite interesting in principle for him. I think he was wrong about the property interest, but yeah.
But in that case, Roberts, you could say Roberts was the swing justice because he sided with other, but I mean,
I don't know about using that language of swing justice, but that's part of the reason
that I think it's bad. So think of in the Obamacare case, Roberts was the swing justice, not Kennedy. It's swing justice is a very problematic idea, but it's true sometimes. But
well, my only comments, I think the odds are pretty high we'll get a good justice. I think Trump did something very unique in preparing a list of whatever it was, 25 people before he came into office. He's been choosing appellate court justices or judges that are very, very good, or at least coming from good sources in the conservative libertarian legal movement that are better than you might expect. Probably half the ones on that list, I would say, are very bad for Roe, but maybe as many as half are no worse than Kennedy. And so I think time will tell. He said he's down to four potential nominees. Now he's going to announce one on July 9th. Two of them, he said, are women. One of those women I think is quite good on Roe, would never overturn it. The other is maybe more questionable. She hasn't made any comments. So, I think we shouldn't be catastrophic about it. On the other hand, as activists, as people who care about this issue, I think we just get prepared because, conservatives obviously feel very passionate about this issue. They're not going to let it die. They haven't let it die for 40 years. We may need to be prepared to fight this out at the state level and work on state legislatures to make sure that they keep the right available and open. And it may produce an interesting sort of civil rights moment. Charitable organizations could be set up to help fund abortions, to help women travel from one place to another. If certain states get more restricted than another, I think there are a lot of things we can do to demonstrate that we're as passionate about maintaining the right as the conservatives are. And it may be that we go into a period in which we have to fight about this again, so we should get active about it. But I'm not catastrophic yet. I think there's a reasonable chance we get a good justice out of this.
Yeah, I don't mean to sound catastrophic. I was just focusing on the issue that everybody's going to be fighting about. There are many good things that will come out of one of these new judges. So I think it'll be really interesting.
Okay, I understand why you wouldn't want to be compelled to support political activity that you don't support, but there are laws against unions doing that, and they can be penalized if they're caught doing that. On the other hand, workers who benefit from collective bargaining agreements, I can see a plausible argument that they should be compelled to pay for those benefits they get. So I was wondering if the solution might be to eliminate the laws that require employers to use unions and or allow an employee to opt out of union membership and negotiate individually with the employer for better or worse?
Yeah, that's a simple answer, yes. That would actually solve the problem. And so it's not so much, I mean, part of the problem, you have to understand the whole area of labor law is so heavily regulated. And that the first problem is compelling employers to negotiate or deal with only one union, and then all of these other problems come after that. But that would solve the problem. Although I still don't think that it's appropriate to make the distinction between political speech and other kinds of speech. And one of the reasons that I think the court is moving in the right direction on that. It's not right to say because the union is acting on your behalf, they get to speak for you. And therefore, you should pay for it. The rule should be: if you like what you see in the union, you join the union. You do it voluntarily. But no matter whether it's political speech or collective bargaining speech or some other kind of speech or just any kind of activity that they're doing on your behalf, you get to decide that, not the government. But the problem is more preliminary than the speech issue. So it's a really good point. Mm-hmm. All right, I think we're out of time. So thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to the Ayn Rand Institute Live podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen. You can also find us on YouTube. If you like this content, please share or leave us a review. For more information, go to AynRand.org.